This is Wellness 101, brought to you by the Institute of Natural Health, your home for common sense, science-based healthcare. Here's your host, Dr. TJ Williams.
And welcome to the show, everyone. I'm your host, Dr. TJ, and with me, as always, is Aaron.
Hi.
Today on the show, so the last couple of shows, we've answered some questions that we have received, and apparently that has gone over very well, because we got flooded with more questions, and so we're just going to take a show, maybe even do another show in the future, and take the time to answer some of these questions that have been sent to us.
Right. There are a number of things that we, you know, have, like, questions that we've gotten that are good questions, but we certainly don't feel like there's enough material to do an entire show on it. But because I think the situations are somewhat common, you know, are similar to what other people would experience, we're like, well, let's just put it all in one show and just kind of gather some of them up. So like TJ said, I mean, this is, you know, by no means even a large number of the ones that we received, but we just kind of chose a number of them to talk about today, and we may do more shows this way.
I wasn't prepared for the amount of emails that would come in saying, hey, you answered questions. What about this? What about that? What about something else? And I mean, I was actually kind of blown away. So thank you to those of you who wrote to us.
People are listening.
Yes, people are listening.
That's what we always say. Yay. We're like, people are listening.
So we'll just jump right in. We've got varying topics today. There's no set schedule. We'll get through as many of these as we can get through, and whatever's left over, well, maybe we'll do another show like this in the future. So the first question that we're going to address is, it came in and basically said this: if I'm going to use sugar, what should I use, a natural sugar or an artificial sweetener? It's actually a pretty good question, because, you know, if we follow mainstream information out there, the food industry would lead you to believe that an artificial sweetener is better for you because it has zero calories, and the, you know, varying dietitians associations and things will say that, you know, if you're diabetic, then, you know, you want something to have artificial sweetener in it, you don't want to have sugar, blah blah blah. Well, that's not entirely true. Artificial sweetener is not good for you. Obviously, we've talked on this show ad nauseum about how bad sugar is for you. But if you're going to consume some sort of sugar, it really truly needs to be a natural form of sugar. These artificial sweeteners are just, they're not good for us. They're several hundred times sweeter in the brain. Our brain registers these things as several hundred times sweeter than sugar. And while these artificial sweeteners may not cause an immediate rise in blood sugar, what happens is this super sweet signal is telling the brain, hey, there's some really sweet stuff going on, and we're going to get some of this. And so what happens long term is we actually increase insulin levels. And when we increase insulin levels long term, while we don't see that immediate rise in blood sugar, we see this long-term rise in insulin, which will cause our blood sugar to drop. And then what happens is we crave sugar. So this is the classic example of, you see someone drinking a diet soda and eating a candy bar. Their body is saying, their mind is saying, if I'm going to drink soda, I need to drink this zero calorie soda because this artificial sugar is better for me than the real thing. But their brain and their drive is saying, hey, your blood sugar is going down. You got to get some actual sugar into your system, or you're going to be in a bad way quick. That's the conundrum that people have gotten into. These artificial sweeteners are not good for you. They're registering in your brain several hundred times sweeter than actual sugar.
Even though they don't taste sugar, because I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I can't drink regular soda. I would never drink regular soda. It's way too sweet. I have to drink diet.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I mean, we already know that science has shown that these artificial sweeteners are hundreds of times sweeter than sugar. They just are. And what all you're doing is you're training your brain to register this sensation of sweetness, not actual sugar. Right? It's no different than if someone's eating tons and tons of sugar and they eat fruit, it doesn't really taste that sweet to them, when in reality, fruit is super sweet. Fruit is nature's candy. But if you take someone who, you know, if we have a diabetic and we take them completely off of all sugar, completely off of all artificial sugar, completely off of all fruit, because that's what's necessary, that's what's needed for them to get better, right? And then they introduce fruit back into their diet once their A1C comes down, their insulin comes down, their blood sugar comes down, they talk about, oh my gosh, I didn't realize peaches were as sweet as they are. It's because they've trained their brain that to not notice the sensation of sweetness.
So you're saying if someone was not used to eating sugar at all and they drank soda, regular soda, and diet soda, one wouldn't taste sweeter than the other?
Now you're getting into chemistry and the science of the food science of this. So what they're trying to do is basically trick your brain.
Yeah.
Right? They're trying to trick your brain to say you need to have more of this. These artificial sweeteners, not only are they several hundred times sweeter than sugar, they're more addicting.
So this is kind of like what we talk about with fast food. Like if you don't normally eat fast food, it's going to be seem extremely rich and like too much for you.
Yeah, and likely super salty and all the other things.
But if you eat it on even a somewhat regular basis, then other food seems like it doesn't have any flavor.
Other food seems bland. Home-cooked meals seem very bland.
We hear that all the time with kids, with people that say, you know, well, if you don't eat chicken at home, we'll only have Kentucky Fried Chicken or only have chicken nuggets at, you know, McDonald's or whatever. So,
because these fast food places and these guys that are in the food industry, they are manipulating your taste buds. They're balancing just the right amount of saltiness, sugar, and fat. They're trying to get this just right to where it drives you to eat more. I mean, Lay's potato chips, their slogan for a long time was "Bet you can't eat just one." I mean, they were working on and perfecting that addictiveness. I think that's a word, right? The addiction of having to eat more,
right?
Because these things, the flavor palate just hits your brain just right. I mean, remember things that you taste, that's just sending these signals straight to the brain.
Which is why if you eat whole foods, healthy foods, you tend to like healthy whole foods and healthy foods. I mean, at least,
correct,
you know, as long as you're seasoning it correctly, it seems like it has a lot of flavor.
That is absolutely correct. That's why people, once they start turning, you know, if they come to us and they're like, I need help and this is what I'm eating, and they're eating lots of fast food or lots of, you know, ready-made meals and quick stuff, and they're just eating horrible for you foods, and we change that and transition them over into an actual food, they will come back to us down the road and talk about how they can't eat such and such anymore. They can't handle this anymore. This is way too sweet for them now. They don't even have the urge to consume that type of food.
That makes sense. It also makes sense though that when people say it just doesn't taste good to me, or, you know, it doesn't seem like it has enough flavor, they're being truthful, probably. It just is going to take a little bit of time, right?
Oh, no, they're exactly being truthful. They're telling you exactly what they taste and what they feel.
So it does really seem bland to them.
That is correct. And you can tell, like, I can tell these people, someone who sits down and start salting their food before they even taste it to see if it actually needs salt, something's messed up in their taste sensation, their taste buds. Something is off. That is not a healthy way to go about eating food.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you say that, but that also makes me think, I've had people who have seen me eat at home, you know, who have been at our house, and I will normally add some salt, and they're like, oh, you add salt, and I'm like, there isn't salt in our food. When you're cooking with whole, you know, they're so used to eating packaged foods that they can't imagine, you know, needing to add salt because salt's already in it. And I'm like, well, when you're eating normal meat and vegetables.
And not to mention that our kids eat what we cook, and it's not healthy for a kid to be eating a heavily salted food.
Right.
Like, that is not good for them. That's not good for them
at all. So anytime we make something, we don't add any salt, and then the kids get it completely unsalted.
Or if we add it, we add very, very little.
And so they get it without any salt, and then we sometimes will add a little more salt when we eat it. But compared to anything you'd get packaged, it's very low.
Yes, very low. And so, and we're actually using we're not using table salt, the sodium chloride, you know, not really good for you at all salt. We're using Himalayan sea salt or Celtic sea salt. We're using actual healthy salts too. So there's that. All right. I think we answered that question enough. Let's move on to question number two here. The next question that we received is, I have heartburn and I'm taking an antacid. I've heard basically that, I'm paraphrasing here, they've heard that we've discussed the why you should not take acid reducers on our show. And then their ultimate question is, what do I do if I have bad heartburn? I need to do something. So that is a fantastic question. There's multiple steps that need to be done if we're really wanting to address the acid levels. You know, short term, you may need an antacid. You may need a crutch, but those things are not made to be taken long term. Now, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into, you know, using an antacid as a crutch versus being on an antacid for 20 years. There's two completely different things here. And so we're gonna get into that, and then what you should actually do for yourself if you feel like you have heartburn, you know, terribly, or you have frequent heartburn, and what you can do, the steps that you can do to reduce that heartburn. You're listening to Wellness 101. Welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in today, we have been answering questions that have been sent to us by our listeners. The first question that we answered was, if I'm going to use a sugar, should I use a natural sugar or artificial sweetener? And we have since moved on to, I have heartburn, I'm taking an antacid. I know I shouldn't be taking an antacid, but what do I do if I have bad heartburn? And so I had said right before the break that taking an antacid as a crutch to give you time to figure out the trigger and why you're having heartburn, that's one thing. Taking an acid reducer for 20 years is a completely different ballgame. I mean, we have people that come into the clinic that are taking some sort of antacid very frequently. And unfortunately, antacids really disrupt your digestion. They change the pH in your stomach, which changes your body's ability to break down food, which changes, you know, what happens when bile and pancreatic juices hit that food. Chemical reactions are different. Nutrient absorption goes way down. It's not healthy for us. So if we do have bad heartburn and we're needing an antacid to get us through because it's just so painful, we've got to figure out what's triggering that. The big thing that we can do, you know, conventionally they'll tell you stop eating acidic foods and stop eating this and that. Yeah. People that have bad heartburn, they've already tried that. The key is to actually test yourself and figure out what foods are potentially triggering this. The other thing to do is get some digestive enzymes. The number one problem with digestive problem of anyone, I think it's over the age of 35, is atrophic gastritis. That means that our stomach is inflamed and it's not making enough stomach acid. That's really what that means. So the number one digestive problem is not making enough stomach acid. It's not too much acid. It's so rare, so few, and so far between that in all the years that I've practiced, in all the hundreds, if not thousands, of patients that I have either consulted with or treated, I've had one person who's actually had too much acid in their stomach. You can test it. It can be tested. It's not a fun test to have to do, but it can be tested to figure out if you have too much acid in your stomach. We've had one. Almost everyone else, they get benefit from getting a digestive enzyme on board, but then it turns into what digestive enzyme? This is where things like a stool test can be beneficial because it can tell us what's being broken down and what's not. Do you need something that helps the gallbladder digest food? Do you need something that increases the amount of acid in our stomach? Do you have heartburn because you have increased intra-abdominal pressure? So you can have all this extra pressure in your abdomen, and that could be forcing food back up into your esophagus, causing heartburn. A lot of times when that's happening, it's from a couple of different things. One, we have lots and lots of gas going on in our small and or large intestine that's pushing this stuff back up. You know, which could be we have a bacterial overgrowth or a bacterial imbalance, or we're just overweight. That can be enough. Another one that a lot of people don't really even consider is poor posture when eating.
Immediately after eating.
Yeah, or immediately after eating. We eat and then we sit on the couch and we're all hunched over. Like, sometimes it's literally just as simple as eat a meal, sit up nice and tall while you eat your meal, and then get up and walk right after you eat.
I was going to say, that's one of the reasons why taking a walk after eating can be so beneficial to people is because it forces you to be upright. You know, you're not going to be hunched over.
Right. And exercise improves motility.
Right.
It gets your digestive system operating. Like, sometimes it's just the simplest little thing that makes all the difference in the world. And, you know, our job for this show is to educate people on steps that they can do on their own. If that stuff's not working for you, by all means, you know, come see us, find a functional medicine practitioner in your area to get some help to figure out what foods that you're sensitive to so you can stop eating the things that may be triggering it. I mean, it could be something as simple as coffee or eggs or, you know, the 5 pounds of dairy that you're eating every single day. There's just so many different things that can be triggering it. Or it could be a health food, a quote-unquote health food that's not good for you. What if you eat broccoli all the time and broccoli is actually the trigger?
Right.
A friend of mine who was like, all right, I need your help, TJ. We've got, this is what's going on. I need to lose weight, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't even talk in our initial consultation about the fact that this lady had heartburn every morning. And so we did her food sensitivities to help her lose weight. And we identified that one of her food sensitivities was eggs. And so she stopped eating eggs. She sent me a message 3 days after she started and was like, TJ, I just want you to know that I quit eating eggs because they were on my food sensitivity and I don't have heartburn anymore. And I've had heartburn every morning for the last I don't know how many years because her breakfast consisted of eggs in some form or another, whether it was an omelet, scrambled, egg whites. It didn't matter. She was eating eggs every single morning because she thought that that's what you do is you get up and you make sure to get some high quality protein in your diet. And while eggs are a high-quality protein, they were terrible for her and were triggering her heartburn. It was mind-boggling to her. She could not believe that something as simple as that was the trigger for all of her issues.
Well, I mean, as far as heartburn, I mean, we hear that a lot because people have been to numerous doctors or have tried a number of different medications. No one has ever brought up food sensitivities. I mean, how often do we hear that?
Right.
That they're just like, seriously? I could just quit eating a certain food and I wouldn't have had to be on this medication this whole time.
Yep. And if you're having heartburn every single day, without testing, you can just identify what foods or drinks you consume every single day or at least every other day and just stop consuming that for 2 weeks and see what happens. I bet your mind will be blown.
Yeah, and we've been kind of led to believe that it has to be spicy food, or it has to be, you know,
or it has to be acidic food.
Acidic food, and that's what, you know, what could possibly cause heartburn. It's not true. We're all unique, and, you know, we all have our individual issues, and so it could be something that no one else has a problem with, but you do, and that's why you have heartburn.
Yep. All right. I want to go on to our next question. The next question is a really good one. This lady wrote in and said, my husband has had gout 3 times in the past couple of years. Is that something you help? Yes, it is. He's now on a preventive medication, but it hasn't seemed to help, and it is extremely painful when he gets it. So for those of you who may not know what gout is this inflammatory disorder that tends to affect the big toes of people who get a gout flare. Makes it extremely painful to walk. It's extremely
painful.
To do
anything.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, like, just they, you know.
Just having a shoe on, it hurts.
Right, or putting the sheet over your yourself at night.
Yes.
Like, it just very simple things. It's that painful.
And it's, I just want to be clear that it's not always just the big toe.
Right.
Sometimes it can be the thumb. And that's the one that really baffles people when they come in and they've got thumb pain and they don't realize that it's gout, because they think that gout is always associated with a foot. But the biggest thing with gout, so I tell people, first and foremost, stop eating meat for a few days. Like, just give it a trial run to get meat out of the system. A lot of times, well, what gout is it's a problem with breaking down purines, and that has to do with meat, and I'm not going to get into all the science of it. I just want to talk about, you know, general overview type information here. So stop eating meat can be very beneficial, and it's an easy thing to do. But sometimes it's not all meat, it's very specific meat. Sometimes it's just red meat that is the problem. And people can have chicken and pork and turkey and things like that. Or sometimes it's land animals that are the problem, and people can have seafood and they have no issues eating seafood. The main thing to do here is to test and figure out what's going on. Another thing that can be beneficial is stool testing, just to see do you have bacterial imbalances or enzyme imbalances that suggest that your body needs some sort of digestive enzyme to help you break down those proteins? Maybe it's just an inability of your body through age or dysfunction that you just need digestive help to help you break these foods down. Sometimes it's literally that simple.
Could drinking more water help?
Drinking more water can help. Stop drinking alcohol can help. Anything that dehydrates you can be problematic. And making sure to have plenty of water. Most people don't realize that they're chronically dehydrated. I mean, in our office, we have a device that allows us to look at body composition of people, and it tells us what people's total body water is, and the vast majority of people are actually chronically dehydrated and they have no idea. Even people who look at me are like, but doc, I drink a gallon of water a day. I'm like, I understand that. You could drink 2 gallons a day. It doesn't matter. You don't get credit for what you drink. You only get credit for what you absorb. And the same is true with eating. You don't get credit for what you eat. You only get credit for what you absorb. And if your system is broken and you don't absorb well, you're setting yourself up for chronic disease, or you're being set up for chronic disease. And this is where we can come in and we can help identify these things to help you get better. Okay? All right, we got to take another break. When we come back, we're going to continue to answer more questions. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in today, we are answering listener questions. And so far, we've answered questions on the topics of sugar, heartburn, and gout. It's a lovely trio of questions. And our next question comes from a mama who was concerned with her 17-year-old daughter. Her question is, my daughter is 17 and has had 5 yeast infections over the past couple of years. Is there a natural way to treat this? So the short answer is yes. I think yeast infections are more common than what most people realize. The general public understands how frequent women deal with yeast infections, and nowadays how much more frequent they are at a younger and younger age. I have some pretty strong opinions on this. I'm not 100% convinced that this is not diet related most of the time.
There can be other causes, but a lot of the time it's diet related.
A lot of the time. I mean, and when it's other causes, well, that may not necessarily be my specialty. But most of the time when I have a new patient on the schedule and our notes, you know, say that, you know, the big complaint is recurrent yeast infections, I can almost guarantee with certainty that they've already been to their gynecologist and have already tried all of the traditional medicine, antifungal medications and things that are recommended on the conventional medical side, and they're not getting help. It's not working.
Well, it's, you know, I think more than, you know, most of the time it will clear up the yeast infection, but then they will get another one. It's the fact that they just keep, you know, a few months later, they've got another one, and a few months later. And so then it's, you know, they're starting to wonder, okay, did it clear it up, or is it, you know, has it ever actually been gone? Why am I getting them over and over and over?
Yes. Happens more than you realize. And a lot of the times I start with things as simple as, let's check out your gut, let's figure out what foods you're consuming. And I know it seems like it's a broken record, but so frequently our digestive system in our body is broken. We're eating foods that are terrible for us. We're eating foods that aren't even actual food. We're eating, you know, highly processed, no nutrient.
Well, and especially
junk.
High sugar, high carbohydrate can really lead to systemic yeast overgrowth,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, a lot of these people, a lot of these women that are having yeast infections, not only are they having that, but when we really get down to it, most of them are going to the dermatologist for some sort of skin thing. They're being treated for eczema or psoriasis or something like that, when in reality it could just be a yeast infection on their skin, or they've got terrible fungal fingernails or toenails, and it's diet driven. Almost all the time it's diet driven and gut imbalance, and we've got this yeast overgrowth just rampant throughout their body, and they just need help, right?
Conventional medical doctors do not test for that.
They don't test for it, and they don't recognize that diet can be the cause of your problems.
Right.
That's where the rub is. Is they're like, oh no, that's not it. Like in conventional medicine, unless it's a severe anaphylactic reaction to something, they don't think that food has any role whatsoever in your health.
Well, and I think it's important, you know, to mention what struck me about this question was that it said what kind of alternative treatments, like, do you treat this? It wasn't even saying like, hey, is there a way to prevent these from occurring? It was saying, hey, because they occur so often, do you have a way to treat them that, you know, is different than what we've tried?
Right.
And I just think that's kind of sad to me that we don't even think about the fact that we could stop them altogether.
So I actually have a little note. Our next question, the exact same ending of the question, when we get to it, is this something that, or is there something you can do to treat this? That's the next question that's coming after we get done talking about this yeast infection. And I've got a note that this question right here tells me that the vast majority of the general public has been brainwashed to believe that healthcare is an outside-in thing, that something goes wrong with you, and then we give you something to fix it. It has. They're not asking, what can we do to stop this?
Right.
That would be an inside out question. That's a, how can I build myself up to be a healthier me? The question, can you treat this, is what do you have? Like I have some magic ball, like magic eight ball that I'm looking into, this crystal ball saying, oh, this is the three things that you need to actually make this go away. When in reality, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make this person healthier. We're figuring out what's triggering the problem. What's the root cause of this? Why is this stuff happening? What's wrong with the person? And we address those issues.
Right, which is one of the reasons why we almost always say, yes, we can help. You know, whatever the condition is, yes, we can help, because we build the body up. We figure out why something is happening and we fix the body so that that no longer happens. We don't just give you something to take away a symptom. It's a completely different way of looking at it.
Yes. And it's a question that we get all the time, and Aaron is correct. Typically, our answer is yes, we can help. And like, just think about that. And if you're listening to this show, just think about how many times you've had something go on, and you're just like, "What can I do? Take to get rid of this?" And it's, you know, let's take headaches, for instance. Lots and lots of people have suffered with a headache at least at some point in their life. And what do people do? They run to grab an Advil or a Tylenol or an aspirin or whatever pain reliever they have at the time, rather than say, why am I getting this headache?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and we say that a lot. You know, anytime you have a symptom, you should get curious. You know, why is this occurring? I get that when something happens, you know, like you get a headache, your initial concern is probably, all right, I want to get rid of the headache. Then I can deal with, you know, what caused it in the first place. If it's something that's recurring, right?
Yes.
But it, you know, a lot of people never get to that second question. They get to like, let's fix it, or, you know, so-called fix it, quote unquote, fix it. You know, let's get rid of the symptom, and then they move on.
Right.
You know, they never get to, okay, what can I change so that I don't experience this in the future.
And this is how people get into my office, taking, in this instance, basically taking a you know, antifungal or anti-yeast suppository every single week to try to keep yeast infections at bay. And then eventually they're just like, okay, this can't be right that I have to do this all the time to not have a yeast infection. Or I have to take 12 Tylenol every single day to not have a headache. Like, at some point, we have to say, what's wrong? What's broken? What do we actually need to address here to stop this from happening, rather than just cover up the symptom over and over again?
Right. Yeah, our point is there's always a reason. I mean, it struck me, because I know we've had people come in before who are very proud of themselves, and yeast infection specifically, for treating it naturally, but had never thought about the fact that they could change something and quit having them. You know, they were like, I don't take, you know, the medication. I'm able to, I know we've heard all sorts of essential oils, like all sorts of different things that people have, you know, said work, you know, to get rid of the symptom. But it's just interesting to us, because, you know, our first thought is, let's just prevent it from happening at all, and then we don't have to work on treatment.
It's a novel concept. All right. I want to shift gears and move on to the next question. This is a good one. This question says, I'm in my mid-20s. I'm going to go ahead with this treat this question. I'm in my mid-20s and I've been experiencing hair loss. Is there something you can do to treat this? Again, this is not something I'm looking into my magic crystal ball and saying, oh, your hair loss, here, take this and your hair loss will stop.
Oh, and I want to point out, I mean, that was a longer question. This was a female, but I mean, this works for both male and female. I mean,
right.
But I know that this, I remember this one specifically, and it was, you know, incredibly distressing because it was a female that was experiencing the hair loss.
Yes. And so, yes, but the answer is let's figure out what's causing the hair loss. There are a lot of different things that can be causing the hair loss. And like, we got to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about different things that can be causing hair loss. and what can be done to help prevent this from happening or stop this from happening and then prevent it, reverse it to where you don't have to deal with it for the rest of your life. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in today, we've been answering listener questions. We've talked about sugars and artificial sweeteners, heartburn, gout, yeast infections, and we're just getting into a female in her mid-20s that's experiencing hair loss. Is there something you can get to treat this? And, you know, the answer is we can help. The real answer is we have to figure out what's triggering the hair loss. There are different things that can be causing hair loss to happen. Typically, we're having to look hormonally, whether it's the thyroid, estrogen, testosterone. You know, these types of things are the main causes of what's driving someone's hair loss. Could be nutrient deficiencies, could be, you know, not having enough protein in the diet. You know, they're like vegans, hardcore vegans can experience some hair loss if they're not getting enough protein. And not because on purpose, they're not realizing, oh, I need way more protein than I'm consuming in a day. Those are your typical reasons for this. So our job is to identify what is it that's actually causing the hair loss? What's out of balance? Now let's start to fix that. Now the issue with hair loss is it's not something that you see turn around really quickly. I mean, you're looking at a good 3 to 6 months of heavy intensive work once we've identified what the issue is to get function and hair growth started again.
And that's just started.
And that's just
right. I mean, that's the issue, especially in the case of a female. You know, who has wants a lot more hair growth. I mean, yeah, it is going to take a while.
So other things out there, if you've already looked in those directions, other things that are out there are infections, chronic infections that you don't even know that they're hidden. You don't even know that you have. Toxic chemicals can be a cause of this. I mean, there are several different things that happen to someone to cause, you know.
What about parasites?
Hair loss, parasites can trigger this sort of stuff.
I just always think that when it's something random, I always think like, that's a possibility.
There are so many things that can happen. I mean, we have a young lady in our office right now. Her hair is finally starting to grow back in, but her hair fell out. I mean, this beautiful young girl, her hair falls out. I mean, what do you do? As a parent, I don't know. I would panic. And like, they started looking for answers and started figuring this stuff out, and their journey led them to us. And you know, we've been working for a few months now, and we've got some hair growth coming back. You know, she doesn't necessarily feel great yet, but you know, we're moving in the right direction, and we can see the outward signs are starting to come back that health is starting to improve. And it's a long road, and it's going to be a long journey, but you know, we're in it for the long haul. We're there to, you know, get this thing turned around and help this young lady out. And she's not alone. Other people have this sort of stuff happen to them.
Well, and it's funny. Actually, what struck me was that I've seen a number of, like, influencers on Instagram that are fashion influencers that have become really big into wigs because of hair loss.
Yep, they're covering
it. That is totally, I mean, no, you know, judgment at all as far as wearing wigs, but it also makes me sad that they, you know, they have just kind of assumed that they drew the hair loss card, right? No one has been able to explain the hair loss. You know, people say, well, maybe it's stress or maybe it's, but they don't really have an answer. So, yeah, our point, like with everything, is there's always a reason.
Yep. All right, we've got one last question that I want to get to. This was one that we picked out. I liked it. The question is this. My pediatrician recommended that I start my baby on rice cereal at 4 months.
Ah.
Yep. As soon as this one came through, I was like, oh, no, we're addressing this one. My pediatrician recommended I start my baby on rice cereal at 4 months. My friend said that's not a good idea. What do you recommend? Yes, we definitely recommend do not start rice cereal. It completely messes up the digestive system of a baby. Babies are that's way too early to start a child on rice cereal.
It's extremely frustrating that pediatricians recommend this. And also, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this is because I see so many people do it that I can't say anything. So I'm, like, yeah. I'm just going to put this out there in case anyone is considering it or has been told it's a good idea.
It's not a good
idea.
It's not. There are so many things. Basically, you're training when you throw rice. Rice is a very easily digested thing. Not to mention that rice is high in arsenic. It's high in the heavy metal arsenic. And so we're
just because of the way that it's processed.
It's raised, grown. It's naturally high in arsenic. And like now we're putting this into an infant whose blood-brain barrier hasn't been fully formed. I mean,
it's kind of like fast food for a baby.
Yeah.
You know, right. I mean, like it goes easily into their system.
And of course they eat it. They think it tastes good.
Right. And then they get a craving for that kind of food. The other thing, I mean, we're saying that it's easy into their system. But one of the other issues is, I mean, I thought this question, I don't know if you said that or not, that they were talking about doing it at 4 months. But
I did.
Amylase is the enzyme that's needed to break down rice, correct?
Correct.
And babies don't start producing the pancreatic enzyme amylase until like 8 months or so.
Right.
So they don't even have it. I mean, they have it a little bit in their saliva, but not enough to break it down.
Correct.
So you're putting something in their system that their bodies simply aren't,
equipped
to handle at that point.
Yep. Yes. So
there's scientific reasons not to do it.
Yes. I always go back to if you can manage it, breast milk at least until you get past 6 months. If you can go to a year, great. Some babies start to get hungrier a little earlier than that. Mama maybe doesn't produce as much milk.
Or what if they're on formula?
Don't even get me started on that. I'm not a huge fan of formula.
Right, but I mean, there's necessities. I mean, certainly.
Sometimes it's necessary. Yes, you're right. And so even if they are on formula, you still don't want to introduce the rice super early. We want to, bring in foods. Bring in actual food when you bring this stuff in. I mean, there are lots and lots of easily accessible charts of what do you bring in at 6 months, at 7 months, at 8 months, at all the way up to a year. Like, they're super simple. And they're readily available. I mean, all you gotta do is Google search, and it can show you very easily. Hey, these are foods that you can bring in when and if you want to know why, I'm sure somewhere it tells you. But it has to do with the sugar content in the food, the starchiness of the food, how easily it is digestible by the baby, and everything needs to be cooked for a baby. Right? It's all got to be steamed or...
At
the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, then they can have raw. One thing I want to throw in really quickly is that a lot of people look at this, rice cereal is an easy fix. It seems like an easy fix. A lot of people will add it to the bottle. You know, they get a little more time for the baby to sleep at night. But, I always look at it, in long term, what's going to be easiest? Not for the baby and for you. So not only is it going to, be harmful to your baby over time because it's going to introduce them to foods they shouldn't be eating and they're going to be craving certain things, but their gut's going to be messed up. So they're going to probably be harder to deal with as they get older.
Yeah.
So just as a form of self-preservation, try to delay that because it'll be easier to parent them.
And think about this. When the digestive system, when the gut is broken, we're talking about everything that goes along with a broken gut ends up being a broken brain. So you end up with higher incidences of ADD, ADHD, depression, anxiety, everything that goes along with our ability to make these neurotransmitters. They're all made in our gut. They're used in our brain, but they're made in our gut. And if the manufacturing process is screwed up, the utilization is not going to be there. Like, it's just the way it is. There's too much information out there that, says, hey, there's a better way to do things. So that's our suggestion, for what it's worth. All right. That's about all the time that we have for today. I hope that you guys really enjoyed having us answer these questions. They were very good questions. If you want more information, please visit us online at inhstl.com. Email us at info@inhstl.com. Call us 314-293-8123. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at INHSTL. Shoot us messages, shoot us questions. If you have anything, we'd love to hear from you. For Aaron, I'm Dr. TJ. This has been Wellness 101. Thanks for listening.